Milwaukee has been deemed one of the most segregated cities in the country. But when it comes to why that is, there isn't as many widely known facts. As an ongoing project from UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab is working to shed more light on how the now outlawed practice of redlining has shaped the city's neighborhoods and how people of color in the city still feel the effects of the policy today. Josh Garoon is an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. He's been contributing to the project. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Remind us what the practice of redlining is and was.
Right. So redlining gets its name from maps that were drawn up by the Homeowners Loan Corporation back in the late 1930s. And it gets its name from the fact that the maps were color-coded. So basically, this organization that was a quasi-governmental organization that comes about after a New Deal Housing Act, the Federal Housing Act 1934, commissions these maps to be drawn up of major cities throughout the country. And the idea of these maps is to determine which parts of which cities, which neighborhoods, are good risks for insured mortgages. And this is because the country is trying to push more mortgages out there. They're responding to people not being able to afford housing, not being able to afford homeownership. So what these maps do is they get realtors, typically local realtors, who go out, they look at the neighborhoods, they come up with neighborhood descriptions. On the basis of those descriptions and the data they collect in those descriptions, they assign a color to each part of the city. And the best areas were green, that was type A, and then you had blue, which was type B, and then you had yellow, which was type C, and then type D is red. And the type D areas were the parts of the cities where the HLC's maps were suggesting to people who were going to be extending these mortgages, don't extend credit there, don't give loans there. And because they were red, because they were these blocks of the city, this practice became known as redlining. And in terms of what the effects of this were, you have to look at who typically lived in these redlined areas. And effectively, if there was any significant population of African Americans or Black people living in these areas, they were redlined.
So let's back up just a little bit. So Sure. We have the green, blue, yellow, and red. So these realtors would go out, they would make their assessment of a neighborhood. What would a neighborhood look like that was, for instance, marked as green?
Right. So it's going to vary a little bit by geography, depending on what the local context was socially, politically, culturally. But typically, it's white. Typically, it's whites of a certain sort. So, for example, in Madison, Italians were not white. So Greenbush, the old Greenbush, the Greenbush Triangle is redlined, actually, because there are too many Italians living there, too many Jews and some African Americans. But if you had Scandinavians and Germans and they were relatively wealthy and the housing stock was in good condition, then that would be a good way for you to have a green or a blue neighborhood. Also, if there was no sense from the realtor that there was a pressure or influx of undesirable people, right?
And it sounds like those undesirables were often the most recent immigrants, because certainly Germans were immigrants, but they tended to come in earlier waves than, say, the Italians.
Exactly. And of course, those ethnic tensions are what's informing the realtors to begin with. If you have people coming in from these ethnic groups who are more dug into the city and who are from those ethnic groups and also in the professional classes, you get this reproduction at the time of the biases, the discrimination, which races, which ethnic groups were desirable and which were unhealthy, which would make a neighborhood go on the decline. And that would lead to a yellow or a redlined area. Some of it has to do with geography in the city, too. It's not like this was 100% based on race and ethnicity, the history of the neighborhood, its proximity to amenities, how close it was to industrial areas or to other parts of the city all played a role. And this is all reflected in those neighborhood descriptions that were generated. But the maps really become the encapsulation of that, because whether someone was going to read through all these neighborhood descriptions to say, oh, do I really believe this is a redlined area, is questionable. And in fact, there's pretty good research, including a paper from three economists at the Federal Reserve of Chicago, showing that these redlining maps didn't only capture the existing reality, but structured it going forward, that you can actually see causally the way these maps become reality as mortgages and credit follow what is drawn out here.
This map construction and coloring, I guess we can say, seems like an enormous undertaking, even if we're only looking at pretty major urban areas. were they ever revised after that first wave of descriptions?
So there's a big debate among historians and others about how much these maps were actually used. They were originally intended for internal use, but depending on whose narrative you follow, they leaked out or they were distributed and people got hold of them. And then people started drawing up their own. So private corporations, banks would draw up their own maps along these lines because it seemed like a good idea. It seemed like a good idea, a good way to capture risk and decide.
I was going to say, I'm sure they portrayed it as risk assessment.
That's exactly what they're doing. You know, they're not denying why they're assessing these risks. And at the time, you know, there is some popular opinion to support the, oh, that's risky. Those people are undesirable. You know, this is before really white flight starts taking place. This is what leads to, in many ways, white flight once neighborhoods start experiencing the disinvestment in certain parts of the neighborhood. And of course, Black people are not passive in the face of this. They're trying to figure out how they can either get out of the redlined areas or figure out other ways around it. And in fact, you start seeing some of the early waves of what could be a precursor to predatory lending. And in the 1960s, once this practice is outlawed and into the 70s, you actually see what's called reverse redlining, where because banks can no longer discriminate in the way they were doing on the basis of these maps, you actually get the first waves of predatory mortgages where they're charging more money to Black people, or they're giving them worse loans, or the insurance or other riders on the mortgage are more punitive, such that Black people are now able to get credit in a way that they weren't with the redlining maps. But it's punitive credit in many ways. It's credit that makes homeownership incredibly risky for them in a way it's not for white people. And the other corollary that is, like I said, this is New Deal era legislation that leads to the creation of the HOLC, where the maps come from. And what the government is doing at the same time is encouraging white people to buy homes, to take out mortgages, and also subsidizing the suburbs. And there's great historical literature on the way the government builds the suburbs up, coaxes white people into the suburbs, gives them these mortgages that are just not available to Black people, who get more or less stuck in place. Patrick Sharkey's written a book that literally titled, and they wind up not being able to get out, not least because they haven't been able to accumulate the wealth, the equity in their homes, because they can't get mortgages. There's disinvestment, the property values fall, the housing stock falls, and you get this vicious cycle whereby even in the absence of redlining after 1968, when the practice is outlawed, there are other forms of redlining or reverse redlining that come in. And that's what the article in WisContext is really speaking to, is the way that this 1930s, 40s era practice can be used to see what we've experienced since then and up to the present day in places like Milwaukee.
We're talking with Josh Garoon. He's an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. And we're talking about a recent look by our colleagues at WisContext at the continuing impacts of redlining, especially in Milwaukee. And Josh, you kind of foreshadowed that there. So it's been over 50 years since redlining was made illegal. But looking at demographic maps of Milwaukee, there's still a very strong correlation. What do you see when you look at those?
Right. So when you look at those maps, what you see is that if you look at what's called a racial dot map, where there's a dot for every certain number of people, maybe 50 people who are categorized in a certain racial or ethnic category, and you make different colors of those for Black people, for people who are Latinx, for people who are white, for people who are generically, unfortunately, Asian, you see that people of color, especially Black people and especially Latin people in Milwaukee, you see that they are bunched in areas that were redlined and to some extent yellow lined. So these type C and D areas back in the late 1930s. And so there is a continuation today of the racial residential segregation, not because these redlining maps are still being used, because again, they were that use is supposed to be illegal, but because you have this persistence over time, and because you have these practices that replace the formal mapped redlining over the duration, whether it's, you know, from the 40s on, 1949, there's a new housing act that comes online with Truman under the Fair Deal. That's the big urban renewal funding act, really one of the first of its kind. And that's when you start seeing money flowing into these redlined areas to demolish them.
And briefly, as we wrap up, are there any positive ways to eliminate this ongoing effect of redlining?
So there are, you know, this is a big part of the question around affordable housing. It's been a big part of questions about studies like Moving to Opportunity, which is a big national study that actually tried to give people vouchers to get them away from these neighborhoods that were historically disadvantaged, especially into upper income neighborhoods, not just to any neighborhood, but specifically to upper income neighborhoods. There's been mixed success there, and the evaluations of that are ongoing. It looks like it takes multiple generations for these sorts of projects to really take off. But I should also say this is one of the central questions in the reparations debate today, which is not, as is sort of caught the buzz of cutting a check to people individually, but rather thinking more structurally about, okay, if we consider redlining as something that broke neighborhoods of color, that broke black neighborhoods, that broke black communities, is there a way to repair that by providing not just affordable housing, but looking more systematically at how we might invest in black neighborhoods, invest in black communities in ways that cut back against what was going on? And there's an ironic twist there because, of course, the 2007-2008 financial crisis had a reverse redlining aspect to it where black churches were recruited by banks into trying to push subprime mortgages. And now I think what we're seeing is can we try to use some of these same mechanisms through a reparative approach that would do the opposite of that and really start trying to repair all of this damage that's been done, not just since the 1930s before that, but really with redlining formalized in the 1930s.
Well, Josh, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Josh Garoon, assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. He was with us to talk about a project he worked on with the UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab, looking at the effects of redlining in Milwaukee. You can find their latest piece and all of WisContext's work on disparities in Wisconsin online at wiscontext.org.